You're listening to the Friday Review on Public Radio WNYX in New York City. It is March 7th, 1969. My name is Jack Schechter. If you've been following the station's coverage of the aftermath of losing the space race late last year, then you're probably aware that the men who landed on the moon have traveled from the Soviet Union to Washington, D.C.
Commander, can you tell us what it felt like to set foot on the moon?
The cosmonauts, along with the two chief engineers of the Soyuz spacecraft, took questions this afternoon in the Rose Garden of the White House.
I recall that it was very dark inside the spaceship. Then the door opened, and it was very bright. And I don't recall anything but the mission. We were successful in retrieving several kilos of specimens for study on Earth.
Even after months of celebrations in the largest cities of the Soviet Union, they seemed a little bewildered by the attentions of American media.
There were reports that Secretary Brezhnev transmitted a message to the Soyuz lander on the moon. Now, what did he say?
I cannot remember if he did, or what did he say. We have heard, of course, a lot of messages from everyone. We hear music playing through the space. I believe the radio.
You heard music from Earth?
No.
That was Mission Commander Maxim Tupolev. A spokesperson for their visit stressed that the cosmonauts have been traveling extensively for the worldwide celebrations and, quote, to please have sympathy for men who are very tired. These tired men will be received later this evening by President Nixon at the State Dining Room in the White House. That's a move which has been roundly criticized. Pundits call it a dangerous precedent to set in the first 100 days of the Nixon administration.
We do not want communists here, and we do not care for the president receiving them like so many visiting dignitaries. It adds to our national disgrace.
That's House Minority Leader Florence Gilchrist, who took to the floor in an impassioned 45-minute speech on Monday.
And I say, Mr. Kissinger should urge the president to arrest those communists as soon as they set foot on American soil.
National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger declined to comment. All right, Jacob, we're rolling. So, when did you first meet Nikolai?
Well, I've never met him. And not in person.
I spoke in the studio with Jacob Bailey, formerly an engineer with NASA's Apollo moon landing program. He arrived at our Midtown studios this morning with a box of postcards. They all carried international stamps with photos on the one side of the usual tourist fare. Colorful waterfronts, natural wonders, old churches, cathedrals. The unusual thing about all these places, though, was that they are all located within the Soviet Union. Mr. Bailey told us that these postcards were written to him by a peer, another aerospace engineer named Nikolai Malakhov. Jacob said that Nikolai is employed by the Baikonur Cosmodrome, where all Soviet spacefaring vehicles from Sputnik to Soyuz were built and launched.
We've been writing for, about 7 years now. He was supposed to have come to the States with the cosmonauts and the rest of the Cosmodrome scientists, but he wasn't on the plane.
Why not?
I don't know. I think something might have happened to him. I'm realizing as I'm talking about it how crazy the whole thing seems. Like, I don't even know what he looks like. If I didn't have this box of postcards, it'd be like he didn't exist.
How did you first start writing to each other?
Well, before he was hired by the Design Bureau, when he was getting his master's, Nikolai wrote a fan letter. This was about 1962. He wanted to ask the astronaut Deke Slayton some technical questions about radio telemetry when you're in space. Really inside baseball stuff. And what Nikolai didn't know at the time was that Deke had an arrhythmia and was grounded from the Gemini program entirely, so the letter just kind of floated around till it got to my desk. And I was so curious about this young guy, clearly smart, clearly working hard on his English, asking a question like that. I should have been suspicious, I guess, given the politics. I mean, the Bay of Pigs was happening right then.
Was anyone at NASA suspicious?
Well, no one knew. No one has known. This is the first time I've ever talked about it.
Jacob explained to me that he and Nikolai became pen pals, learning the intricacies of each other's fields of work, sharing insights as they moved up the ranks in their respective programs.
Well, I don't know how he characterized it, but we sure became friends. I think he's probably my best friend. I haven't kept in touch with anyone from my childhood or college. I don't have any family out here. They're all back in Iowa. And my coworkers and I haven't had any reason to see each other since we were all laid off. I mean, what do you talk to your coworkers about if there isn't any work, right? So I've been following the news, and I hope that Congress... Well, I guess no one really sees the point of space travel anymore, so I'm just sort of waiting for a lot of things. These. I love these. These are all pictures of Soviet architecture from right after the war. See, you know, a lot of people really hate this style, but I really like it.
He showed me several postcards of imposing gray concrete buildings, symbols of the austerity and orderliness of the post-war regime.
Now, this one's funny. I mailed him a baseball cap with the Apollo emblem on it, and he promised to send me some Russian candy in return, I haven't gotten it yet.
The handwriting was compact and geometric, reflective of someone whose first language isn't English, but who shares the common tongue of mathematics.
Now, this is the one where I started to think that something was off.
Could you read it, please?
Sure. Dear Jacob, Vlad on my mind again, deja vu at work, noticing strange patterns, probably from the ramblings of exhaustion.
He's talking there about Vladimir Komarov, who died in the Soyuz 1.
He knew him well. That was a hard one to recover from.
What are the patterns he was referring to?
Well, it was payload numbers appearing incorrectly over and over again. So he would fix them, and then a few days later, they'd be back to the wrong numbers again.
Did he explain why?
Well, no, but it was happening frequently enough to be suspicious. See, guys in my profession, we know the vehicles inside and out, right? Every nut, every bolt and washer. And these incorrect numbers were troubling because if something was off in one place, it affected everything on down the line. And because they kept reappearing, it meant that somebody else was making them reappear. So he fixated on it.
In the weeks following the launch, the tone of the postcards became increasingly unfocused and erratic. Some bordered on the obsessive.
Everyone was under the gun for the moon landing. Nikolai told me that the Kremlin set the date and told everyone to work backwards from there. So I should point out that that's kind of the Soviet style, set a deadline and then see what happens. In a lot of ways, I really admire that. But there was a lot of tension, a lot of pressure that began a downward spiral. So Nikolai wrote to me one day that there was a knot he couldn't untie. See? He used those exact words. When he told me that, I got scared.
Why?
Okay. This wasn't reported in the news, either here or there. It was the day before they were going to launch the Soyuz 1 in 1967. Nikolai's boss, Vasily, gave their flight director a list of over 200 errors in the spacecraft. 200. It was a certainty that the mission would be catastrophic.
And they still launched?
Well, that's how much they wanted to beat us. That's how much pressure there was. Nikolai begged Komarov to refuse the mission, but he wouldn't do it.
Why?
The backup pilot was Yuri Gagarin, the first human being in space. Right? He was already a legend. And if he had refused, Komarov would have sent him to his death.
We asked the Kremlin to confirm this information, but as of this broadcast, they have yet to make a comment.
So, the knot he couldn't untie. Around the end of November, his boss, Vasily, starts acting strangely, staying out all night drinking, which isn't unusual for a Russian, granted, but the drinking would continue on to the next day and the day after. See, he'd have outbursts at meetings, making basic mistakes in his arithmetic. It was freezing cold, and he would just walk to work without a coat. And by the end of the year, Nikolai was carrying his entire department. Nikolai described a look in Vasily's eyes, as if he had a burden he would gladly give away if only he knew how, he wrote. Those were the words he used. There was something going on, something Nikolai felt Vasily was close to saying, something to do with the payload numbers, but the day after Christmas, Vasily killed himself. They pulled him out of the river.
This was confirmed by the Kremlin. They called it a tragic end to a noble career in service to the endeavor of human spaceflight.
He seemed to have killed himself, anyway. I mean, it was called a suicide and immediately forgotten. If you could burn secrets in a power plant, the whole of the Soviet Union would have electricity until the end of time.
So what makes you think he's disappeared?
Well, he didn't say what, but he said he found it. The reason for the discrepancy in the numbers. He said he was going to present his findings to the chief designer. And that was the last I heard of him.
He showed me the last postcard that he received. Nikolai said, "If anything happens to me, you're the only one who can fix this."
This can't happen again. They can't just do this to people.
I could really see the pain in Jacob's eyes. This was someone who felt understood by only one other person in the whole world, in the only part of the world where our own government would advise against having a friend, and now that friend seemed to be gone. The question of Nikolai's identity still remained, so I made a call.
Hello, this is Barnaby.
Hi, Barnaby, it's Jack.
Jack, dingoes, bonkers, it's been a real banana bender trying to find this sus for you.
I called Barnaby Cream, a correspondent for Reuters currently assigned to Moscow, previously working in the Sydney offices.
Spent all Arvo in the Federal State Statistics Service. The Ruskies, they call it Rofstat. Me, I call it a recipe for hitting the terps. All gray filing cabinets and stacks of paper. It's a real dog's breakfast in there.
All right, what did you find?
This bloke Nikolai, either he never existed, or he's gone walkabout.
You couldn't locate any census data on Nikolai Malakoff?
Bugger all, mate. Bit iffy if you ask me. Your fellow Jacob, you think he's on the up and up?
Yeah, I think so. The postcards he's showing us would be difficult to fabricate at that volume.
Oi, for drumbers and gallas, you can't tell if he's fair dinkum or handing you John Dory's ham sandwich?
No, his story is that no one else has seen these postcards. Any corroborating information would be extremely helpful.
Well, I like a grommet as much as the next one. Tell you what, I'll give it a bell at the Ministry of General Machine Building. There's a Sheila there working front desk who did the runner on me at an embassy shindig a fortnight ago. A right bloody prawn, but a cheeky ocker. See if she can't let an old surfy like me in to have a Captain Cook of the good oil.
All right, that sounds good.
No worries, mate.
This program will continue to investigate the identity, whereabouts, and reasons for the disappearance of Nikolai Malakoff. And now, WNYX reporter Catherine Snell is reporting live from the White House for the state dinner honoring the first human beings to set foot on the moon.
A photo of the orbiting Soyuz spacecraft hangs over the main entrance to the state dining room. The little capsule is shaped like a diving bell with large solar panels attached like ears. The silver foil covering the exterior reflects the oceans and clouds of Earth below. Seven Russians and one Czechoslovak sit at a long banquet table on one side of the podium with a presidential seal. On the opposite side sit nine American scientists and engineers who, until earlier this week, worked for NASA. The feeling in the room is formal but not cold. The unusual circumstances of this historic meeting are keeping everyone friendly but also reluctant to talk politics, which is curious considering the guest list. In attendance are National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, I can see Congresswoman Florence Gilchrist, Cardinal Patrick O'Boyle, the actor Paul Newman, Justice Thurgood Marshall. The White House Chief of Protocol has definitely had her hands full with the seating arrangements.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President and First Lady of the United States.
President Nixon and Pat Nixon have entered the room, waving to the assembled guests. The Soviet rocket scientists and cosmonauts are standing to greet them. It took the cosmonauts a moment. It looks like they didn't realize they were supposed to stand. And the President is taking his place behind the podium.
Thank you. Thank you. Please be seated. My distinguished guests from the Soviet Union, my fellow Americans, it is an honor and a privilege to welcome the ambassadors of our planet and the great minds of our two space programs. I speak for all Americans when I say we are proud to have made the journey with the Soviet Union towards a scientific achievement that belongs to us all.
President Nixon has raised his glass to the Soviets to his right. And it appears they are not returning his toast. Perhaps the translation didn't come through their earpieces, but one would think the gesture is clear.
So, thank you. And welcome to the White House.
The president is... Well, he doesn't look happy with the way that exchange just played out. He's back in his chair, his arms are folded. His wife, Pat, is saying something to him. But he's shaking his head no, maintaining eye contact with the Soviets. And they have not touched their champagne flutes. This is very strange. One of the cosmonauts just yawned. The podium's empty right now. They seem to be waiting for one or the other to say something. I've never seen anything like this. Oh, good. Vasily Mishin, the chief engineer of the Soyuz spacecraft, is stepping to the podium. He's a compact, muscular man. He sweeps the room with a sharp gaze. He's pointing emphatically at his chest, at his fellow scientists. He's making some kind of proclamation. He's the translator.
The exploits of our cosmonauts represent the greatest achievement of the Soviet Union and demonstrate the advantage of the socialist system. The genius and labor of Soviet scientists, engineers, workers, and collective farmers are making erstwhile dreams a reality.
And he's sitting back down. Nobody else seems to... Oh, the president just stood up, and he's... He's leaving.
I'm sorry, Catherine. Did you just say that Nixon was leaving?
He's out of the room. Pat Nixon, his chief of staff, all the senior advisors, they all walked out. Everyone in the room is at a loss for words. You know I hate to editorialize.
I wish you would.
This was a diplomatic catastrophe.
Why do you think that the Soviets were so undiplomatic?
If I had walked on the moon, I'm sure I'd want to rub it in. Especially after the president's toast, where he gave America partial credit for a Soviet achievement.
Catherine, would you try to find somebody working there for college credit and see what you can get out of him?
Will do. Standing by at the White House for WNYX, this is Catherine Snell.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. An historic meeting of East and West, all too brief, all too awkward. We'll return to the story right after these messages. You're listening to the Friday Review. I'm Jack Schechter.
We have ignition sequence start.
The Soyuz Files is presented by the West. The radio play was written by Spencer Devlin Howard, based on a postcard adventure by Nathan Turner and Spencer. You can see more of the Soyuz story at SoyuzFiles.com. It features the vocal talents of Kate Scott Campbell, Spencer Devlin Howard, Sam Hunter, Claire Kaplan, and Nathan Turner. The dramaturg was Shannon Stockwell. The Soyuz Files was recorded at Vox Studios and The Echo at the Atwater Village Theaters. We would like to extend our thanks to Chris Fields, Alex Freeman, Andre Zinka, Tunde Skovran, the archivists at NASA, and our moms and dads for helping us make this happen. And an extra special thanks to all of those who donated to Lady into Fox. The West is a multimedia storytelling collective based in Los Angeles with works on the stage, on the screen, and in your earbuds. If you'd like to see more of what we do, please visit us online at thewest.la.